The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
CBS News Radio presents the Intelligence Matters Podcast, taking you inside the biggest stories in national security.
How concerned are you?
I'm concerned that the Russians never left.
Each week, former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell, interviews top leaders from the U.S. intelligence community.
James Clapper,
Senator Mark Warner of Virginia,
Mike Hayden.
And lucky for you, you won't need a security clearance to listen. The Intelligence Matters Podcast. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. From the Capital One Bank Studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Year-End Roundup. Here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
In the next hour or so, we'll remind you of the big stories in 2018 and analyze their impact. You'll hear from a team of CBS News correspondents and analysts around the world. It was undoubtedly a big year of news, but let's start with the Me Too movement and its sweeping fallout. Here's correspondent Pam Coulter.
What began as sexual misconduct allegations against movie mogul Harvey Weinstein turned into a social movement. Thousands of women took to social media in 2018 to say, "Me too." Among them, former CBS News correspondent Connie Chung, who revealed she had been an assault victim 50 years earlier.
We remember exactly what happened to us and who did it to us. We remember the truth forever.
Hundreds of prominent men faced allegations and consequences, tattered reputations and lost jobs. Among them, Chef Mario Batali, New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, and CBS head Les Moonves, who was accused of sexual misconduct by multiple women. Others complained about an atmosphere of harassment in the company, something Moonves earlier talked about preventing.
I think it's important that a company's culture will not allow for this.
He is no longer with the company and was denied a $120 million severance package. The corporate world also responded to misbehavior in the ranks. Team owner Mark Cuban didn't make excuses after an independent review documented a toxic environment in the Dallas Mavericks front office. He pledged $10 million to organizations that support women's leadership and fight domestic abuse.
The tears that I saw, it hurt.
Google employees walked off the job around the world.
Time is up.
Demanding change.
Take seriously claims of people who are harassed and respond to them appropriately and not sweep them under the rug.
Google CEO said the company got the message and would change policies on the handling of harassment complaints.
Also a big part of the Me Too movement, the accusations of sexual misconduct against then Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. We'll have more on that later. Also on the minds of Americans right now, the economy. Let's talk with CBS News senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, you tell us not to get too worked up about the day-to-day of the stock market, but the tail end of 2018 hasn't been too good to it.
Look, I get that having a volatile market can be so unnerving for people. And I also understand that you might have an urge to do something. But rarely is there anything really to do except to remind yourself, I'm a long-term investor. Even if I were retiring next year, I need my retirement accounts to last me probably 20, 25 years. And that it's really hard to time the market. I would almost say impossible. You might get one decision right, whether to buy or sell at the right time. Chances are you're not going to get the other decision right, getting back in or getting out. So I think that the volatility has been a story because really over the summer it was pretty calm and then things picked up in a huge way. The stock market indexes all peaked for the year late September, early October. And that was after we had a correction back in February. So it was a big ride up and only to see those gains kind of snatched away as we came into the November, December months. Again, it really is not a great idea to try to guess the next, say, 1, 2, or 10% in the stock market. Better that you should actually save a little bit more when these things happen.
What's also on the mind, Jill, of investors? I assume the Fed is one of them, with Chair Jerome Powell announcing December 19th that the Fed has decided to again raise interest rates a quarter of a point to 2.5%.
Neither the pace nor the ultimate destination of any further rate increases is predetermined. We will adjust monetary policy as best we can to keep the expansion on track, the labor market strong, and inflation near 2%.
Here's what we know. The Fed has been tightening or raising interest rates for pretty much consistently over the last couple of years. It started in December of 2015. Next year, most investors and economists think the Fed will raise at least two more quarter points. Whether they do or not is unknown, but those interest rates, they do impact all of us, either as savers or as borrowers.
Also, trade disputes with China and tariffs have been weighing down the stock market as well.
We're cracking down on countries that cheat and placing tariffs on countries that unfairly subsidize their goods and dump them into our markets like they were doing with steel.
I think that the beginning of the year when we were first starting to hear about tariffs, we had no real understanding of, number one, what we were staring at, and number two, whether or not this would be an issue that would persist into 2019. What we know now is some of the original tariffs that were announced are still in place, steel and aluminum tariffs. And we also know that tariffs on Chinese imported goods, those are also in place. We do have a 90-day reprieve right now where the U.S. and China are trying to settle in on what happens next. But I think the uncertainty around the trade policy in the United States is something that really does tend to spook investors. Although we have the reformatted NAFTA, hasn't made a big change. It did relieve some of the anxiety, as did some of the negotiations with the European Union. But still, the big thorn in the side of investors tends to be the U.S.-China trade disputes. These are the two largest economies in the world. And in 2019, if we do see an escalation of that, of those war of words, and then with actions, that could start to impact the real economy.
And finally, Jill, we've had more than a year to prepare for this, but taxes are changing, including how we file our returns. What's different?
The biggest difference on the tax side is that there are going to be many more people who claim the standard deduction. So the standard deduction nearly doubled. And that means that according to the IRS and some estimates that are out there, somewhere between 85 to 90% of taxpayers are going to claim that standard deduction. They're not going to itemize and look up all those different items like mortgage interest or charitable donations. And for those people, it's going to be a much easier tax filing season. For those who live in high tax states where you used to claim state and local taxes against your itemized deductions, this could be a tough year. There are some small business owners who are going to find it's a tough year. And overall, I think that this is going to be an important first year for individuals to determine, do I need to do something different in 2019? Do I need to withhold more or maybe less? And what lessons do I learn from this year so that I can readjust my planning going forward?
CBS News senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger on 2018 and what's next in 2019. Thanks, Jill.
Thank you.
Stay with us. We'll have a lot more as we look at the year 2018, including that dramatic cave rescue in Thailand.
A massive downpour happened, flooded the cave, and they were trapped.
On the CBS News Year-End Roundup.
On the CBS News Year-End Roundup, a special program recapping 2018. Here's Steve Dorsey.
A changing of the guard for the House of Representatives, where Democrats gained ground in the midterms and Republicans made advances in the Senate. More from CBS News correspondent Bill Rakoff in Washington.
Don't boo, vote!
Midterm elections in this country don't generally stir up the passions, but 2018 was different.
Unvetted illegal aliens trying to flood into our country.
President Trump said the election was about him, and many voters agreed.
I'm voting to get more people in there who will promote the legislation that he's endorsing.
Well, the Republicans are an embarrassment, and they've been very mean.
The battles played out from Texas, where Ted Cruz held off his challenger.
Beto O'Rourke wants higher taxes.
I am honored to have been able to do this with you.
To Florida, where it took well past Election Day to decide the Senate and governor's races.
With so much at stake, Republicans are alleging voter fraud, and Democrats are crying voter suppression.
And when the dust cleared, Republicans slightly increased their majority in the Senate, but women and minorities gained a stronger foothold in both chambers, and Democrats gained control of the House, with Nancy Pelosi seeking to be Speaker once again.
I'm just proud of saying three words, majority, majority, majority.
Union.
Bill Rakoff, CBS News.
Turning to Asia now, with correspondent Ben Tracy in Beijing, let's start with Mr. Trump's summit in Singapore with North Korea's Kim Jong-un amid efforts to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula.
Chairman Kim has the chance to seize an incredible future for his people. Anyone can make war, but only the most courageous can make peace.
You were in North Korea, Ben. You saw that regime up close. What did you learn?
Yeah, you know, I've now been to North Korea three times. We went to North Korea twice this year. The first time we went was really an extraordinary trip where we were put on a train and brought up to their nuclear test site where they made a big show of blowing up entrances to test tunnels saying, look, we're disabling our nuclear test site. The jury is still out as to what they actually did that day in terms of did they disable this site or was that just kind of an elaborate show. They still have not allowed in international inspectors to go verify if that site is actually unusable. You know, it's been an interesting year with North Korea. You know, on the one hand, you could say a year ago we were still knee-deep in fire and fury and North Korea calling the president old and senile and a barking dog and all that kind of stuff. Certainly there's a kinder, gentler tone. I don't think fundamentally, though, anything has actually changed. North Korea still has every weapon it had this time last year, probably more, because they're still carrying on with their program, even though they're not testing missiles. They're still building them. And there has been no real step towards denuclearization.
Also in that region, Ben, another story you've been following where you are right now, China and its relationship with the U.S. amid these tariffs. What's the outlook for this important international relationship?
I honestly think this is the biggest story of the year over here and perhaps really anywhere in the world in terms of where this goes from here. You know, this started off as kind of a simmering trade skirmish that I think one would now have to say is a full-on trade war. However, I think over time, over the course of this year, what the Chinese now believe is that this is not just a trade war, that this is really an effort by the United States to contain China, to contain China's rise. And that's why you are now starting to see comments that we are now entering a new Cold War with China. That's going to have broad implications that go well beyond trade. You're talking military implications. What's going on in the South China Sea right now with China militarizing that part of the world, the United States sending in warships. So I think this is a big deal. I think you might see a little bit of give and take on the trade front. I don't think that's going to fundamentally change the course of where this relationship is going, and where this relationship seems to be heading is not a good place.
Also in 2018, Ben, that dramatic cave rescue of that youth soccer team from that cave in Thailand. Remind us about how that unfolded.
Well, you had 12 kids and their soccer coach. They had just finished practicing for the day, and they decided to go exploring in a nearby cave. This apparently, we learned later on, is something they had done before. However, this was the rainy season there in Thailand, and as they were in this cave, a massive downpour happened, flooded the cave, and they were trapped. So all we knew in the early days of that is that these boys disappeared, and they were believed to be in this cave. Frankly, the day we were sent down there to start covering this story, we thought we were going for a story where a couple days in, these boys unfortunately would be found dead inside of this cave. As the world now knows, that is not how this turned out. There was this miraculous rescue of all of them, of all 12 kids and their coach inside the cave.
How many of you? 13. Brilliant.
And the rescue itself was unprecedented and highly specialized, using divers from across the world and experts.
These guys put themselves in a lot of jeopardy to go in there and try to save these boys. And they did. You know, they had to teach these boys how to dive, how to put on these dive masks and use oxygen tanks to get them through parts of that cave that were so flooded there was no way out besides going underneath the water. This was a monumental rescue effort. And I think pretty much everyone was shocked that everyone came out alive, and that really after just a few days in the hospital, these boys were in pretty good shape.
Also in Southeast Asia, Ben, you saw the aftermath of that devastating tsunami and earthquake in Indonesia.
Ya Allah, tsunami, ya Allah! Ya Allah, kota Palu, ya Allah!
What did you see when you were there?
The earthquake and tsunami in Indonesia was by far the the worst story that we covered this year. The devastation was just unbelievable to see. We landed in Palu at an airport that was destroyed, and you had people just all over the runway waiting for planes to land to get them out of there because basically where they lived had become hell on earth. You had neighborhoods where the earthquake had liquefied the ground and just swallowed up the houses, basically turned the ground into quicksand. So you'd go into some of these neighborhoods and you'd see, you know, what appeared to be a neighborhood that maybe had been built on a hillside or kind of an elevated area. And then we'd talk to people and they'd say, no, this was flat. That is the earth that jutted out and pushed those houses up and sunk those other ones. It was devastation, damage I have never seen before. And frankly, this sounds horrible to say, but you don't get the smell of death out of your head for a really long time after something like this. And sadly, we saw so many body bags, so many families mourning, so many people just on the side of the street wailing because they had just found out that their loved one was dead. It was really horrendous.
And a recovery, I'm sure, will take many more months, if not years. CBS News correspondent Ben Tracy, covering Asia on the Year-End Roundup. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Just ahead, the battle over the Supreme Court leaves scars.
My family and my name have been totally and permanently destroyed.
On the CBS News Year-End Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS News Radio app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up.
CBS News Special Report.
It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, Weekend Roundup, or the CBS Evening News with Jeff Glor.
We're going to begin with our interview with the president late this afternoon.
You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS News Radio app for iOS or Android. Download it today. From the Capital One Bank Studios at the CBS News Washington Bureau, this is the Year-End Roundup with Steve Dorsey.
As we've been reporting, our top story in the Year-End Roundup is, of course, the Me Too movement and its fallout. And a big part of that? The battle over the Supreme Court's newest justice that kicked off in June.
The retirement of Justice Anthony Kennedy from the Supreme Court.
A contentious confirmation for Brett Kavanaugh.
Kavanaugh's not welcome here!
With allegations of sexual misconduct.
I believed he was going to rape me.
And an angry rebuke.
This confirmation process has become a national disgrace.
A divided Senate ultimately backing Kavanaugh.
The ayes are 50, the nays are 48.
As the president took Kavanaugh's confirmation to the midterm campaign trail.
Did they treat him badly? A great scholar, a great intellect, a great person.
The court also setting other milestones in 2018.
The court's most conservative members defended the travel ban from the bench.
They've ruled 5-4 that states can't force non-union workers to pay union fees.
Justices ruling for a baker who refused to make a gay wedding cake.
But the court's ruling was narrow.
The court also paving the way for more states to approve sports betting.
The court struck down a federal law that banned gambling on sports games in most of the country.
Back to those Kavanaugh hearings. Let's talk now with CBS News correspondent Nancy Cordes on Capitol Hill. Nancy, what was the impact of that?
You know, that was a really ugly situation. And I've seen a lot of ugly situations on Capitol Hill over the past 10 years, Steve. But I think what people didn't realize was that this was not just a fight over Brett Kavanaugh himself and whether he himself was a viable candidate for the Supreme Court. It really got to the heart of one of the biggest decisions that senators ever make on Capitol Hill. And that has to do with not just naming someone to the Supreme Court, but changing the balance of the Supreme Court. It was clear that if Brett Kavanaugh made it onto the Supreme Court, we were going to have something that we just don't see very often. Every couple of decades, a change in the balance of the court. It would become markedly more conservative. And that's why you had sort of this no-holds-barred fight between Republicans and Democrats over something that should have been treated with incredible sensitivity, which is an accusation of sexual assault. And it really brought out the worst in a lot of people, people who should have known better. And that's because at the heart of it was this just incredible political battle with Republicans well aware that if they didn't do this now, it might become more difficult after the November elections if they were to lose seats in the Senate.
Heading into this new Congress, Nancy, the House will, of course, be controlled by Democrats. How do you think it will or won't work with the GOP-led Senate and the White House?
I think it all depends on how badly the president wants to build up a legacy of achievement over the next 2 years. If he wants to get big things done, he will have no choice but to work with Democrats. And so, you know, that is going to require the exercise of some muscles that folks around here haven't had to use very much over the past couple of years. They've been pretty good at doing some things that, you know, don't take a lot of heavy lifting, you know, and don't require them to compromise too dramatically. But when it comes to doing big things, new things, you know, that's something that both sides rarely attempt anymore when you think about, you know, things like immigration reform or entitlement reform. Nobody even dares to go there. So if the president wants to be able to run for reelection saying, you know, I managed to get big things done even during divided government, then he's going to have an incentive to work with Democrats. We know that Democrats themselves are going to feel pressure to come up with some plans that they think that they can compromise on with Republicans, because they, too, are trying to show the American people in advance of the 2020 presidential elections, hey, look, we are the party that can govern. We can get things done as well. So the two sides are going to have an incentive to work together. Whether they're able to is another matter. First of all, you're going to have Democrats launching all kinds of investigations into the president that is going to make him angry. He's already said that that's a non-starter for him, but he has changed his views before, and he could change them again. You know, and they're also going to be trying to send a message with some of their legislation by passing bills that they know that Republicans won't support. In order to essentially make a point that Republicans don't support them, things like voting reform to make it easier for people to vote, to cut down on voter discrimination. You know, they're going to pass bills like that, bills on guns, universal background checks, that kind of thing, things that Democrats have been waiting to do for years and realize, you know, still won't likely go anywhere because they'll get stalled in the Republican-led Senate and certainly at the White House. But they still want to put political pressure on Republicans and send a message about what they stand for, the same way that Republicans, for example, voted to do away with Obamacare time and time and time again because they wanted to send a message to their base.
And Paul Ryan.
I'm announcing that this year will be my last one as a member of the House.
What do you think his legacy will be as House Speaker?
Well, he certainly didn't last very long, which I think is a sign that he saw that things were only going to get more difficult for him rather than easier. He was something of a reluctant House Speaker. He came in because his predecessor had been forced out by the right wing of his party. And in a way, something similar was happening to Ryan as well, which sort of begs the question, is there anyone that can really satisfy the Republican conference at this point? Certainly, Kevin McCarthy is going to have a big challenge on his hands if he wants to do that. You know, among the things that really animated Paul Ryan, you had entitlement reform, something he really cared about.
We have to address entitlements. Otherwise, we can't really get our handle on our future debt.
At various points, he pushed privatizing Medicare and vouchers and that sort of thing.
We can also fix our fiscal problems, which are the healthcare entitlement programs.
He also claimed to care very deeply about the deficit and the debt, and he cared a lot about tax reform. He got one of the three. He insisted that a tax reform was going to have a beneficial impact on the deficit and debt. And he leaves Congress without having proven that. In fact, the debt and the deficit are up. pretty significantly. And so the question is, is that a short-term impact? And will he be able to claim credit in years to come for creating a more robust economy and therefore helping the deficit and bringing in all this new tax revenue? Or, or is it a problem that someone in the future is going to have to solve?
CBS News Chief Congressional Correspondent Nancy Cordes. Happy holidays, Nancy.
Thanks. Same to you, Steve.
Coming up on the year-end roundup.
Thousands of migrants, mostly from Central America, at the U.S. border with Mexico.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio. And I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey. And this is the CBS News year-end roundup.
On the CBS News year-end roundup, a special program recapping 2018. Here's Steve Dorsey.
After a 7-year-old Guatemalan girl died in the custody of U.S. Border Patrol agents, the treatment of migrants is back in the spotlight following a year of tensions at the southern border prompted by White House action. More from correspondent Jim Taylor.
The president says illegal immigrants are not welcome here.
We don't want them.
Thousands of migrants, mostly from Central America, at the U.S. border with Mexico. Part of an unprecedented wave.
The number of migrant families entering the U.S. illegally surged to record levels.
Traveling under the harshest conditions.
Every day I thought was my last, he said. I was worried about dying from exhaustion or dehydration or cold.
Administration reaction, a controversial policy separating families, thousands of children taken from their parents, many not reunited.
Hey, hey!
Prompting protest demonstrations in American cities.
Hey, hey! Ho, ho!
A week before the midterm elections, President Trump ordered thousands of troops to the border. But it was U.S. border guards who would fire tear gas at a group of migrants in Tijuana in November. At the end of the year, thousands of migrants remained in Mexico, their fate in limbo. Mr. Trump continued calls to end birthright citizenship and change asylum laws, and he repeated his insistence on funding for a border wall. Jim Taylor, CBS News.
Let's talk now with correspondent David Martin at the Pentagon on the year in defense and national security. David, let's start with one of the byproducts of U.S. outreach to North Korea, the repatriation of Korean War remains. You met a son whose father's remains were identified by Pentagon investigators.
So far, only two have been identified. That's closure for two families. We spoke to one of those families, the son of Master Sergeant Charles McDaniels.
I just put my hand on my father's skull, head, and said a little thank you prayer to God that even to have this, it's more than I ever expected, honestly.
But there is an estimated 5,300 American servicemen who went missing in North Korea. So this is work that is going to take years with even the best of cooperation.
And is that because of the challenges of identifying the remains or because some remains aren't even American?
It's a combination of factors. One is the simple scientific process that you have to go through in order to separate the remains, identify them as likely belonging to a U.S. Servicemen, and then finding forensic evidence, teeth, DNA, to corroborate it. But beyond that, there's the issue of finding the remains to begin with. The location of many of these remains is well known because the location of the battles in which these soldiers died is well known, and there were mass graves. They could go to some of these sites in short order, but the North Koreans impose very onerous conditions because they are suspicious that we are up to something else besides the simple recovery of remains.
I also want to take a look at the role of U.S. troops in Western Africa. That's where more than a year ago, as you know, David, troops were ambushed in an attack in Niger. What has the fallout been since?
It's the repercussions that have flowed throughout the year of 2018. It took 7 months for investigators to figure out how what was supposed to be a simple reconnaissance patrol in which soldiers went out and met local villagers somehow turned into a kill and capture mission against a terrorist, a mission for which they were not prepared. The investigation ended up blaming commanders in the field, relatively low-ranking commanders in the field, for mistakes they made. But it also found systemic failures, which could only be blamed on officers who are higher up in the chain of command.
Meanwhile, David, in 2018, there was also legal challenges to the Pentagon's ban on transgender troops serving the country.
A number of federal courts have blocked the ban. So as of now, the military is still accepting transgender recruits, although the Justice Department recently asked the Supreme Court to allow the ban to go into effect temporarily while the cases work their way through the courts. If the Supreme Court upholds the ban, then transgenders would no longer be allowed to enlist in the military. But those already serving would be allowed to stay, which, after all, is only fair because many of them had declared themselves as transgender only after the Obama administration had lifted the ban.
Finally, David, a topic lots of folks like to discuss, the Space Force.
In my direction, the Pentagon is now working to create the sixth branch of the American Armed Forces. It's called the Space Force. Very important.
Are we any closer to seeing that?
I think it's almost certain that Space Force is going to happen. Whether it takes the form President Trump wants it to take is another matter. He wants a brand new service, so that when you speak of the armed forces, you're talking about the Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, and Space Force. But only Congress can create an entirely new service. And with the House now in Democratic hands, it doesn't look like the president has the votes. And politics aside, there are good arguments against the kind of Space Force President Trump wants, namely that it creates a lot of overhead costs, everything from new uniforms to new staffs. And this is an institution, the Pentagon, that already has way too much overhead. But everybody agrees, you know, space is vital to the way the military fights and the way the rest of us live with GPS and other satellites. Everybody also agrees that today's satellites are too vulnerable to being taken out by either Russian or Chinese anti-satellite weapons, and that would be a disaster for the way we live and again, the way the U.S. military fights. But the question is, do you really have to create a new service to solve those problems? Or can you just elevate the current Space Command to a higher level in the chain of command? So you have a Space Force, but you don't have an entirely new service. That's what the Pentagon did with Cyber Command, which used to be buried down a couple of levels in the bureaucracy, but as cyber attacks became a greater and greater threat, it was elevated to the point where it is now commanded by a four-star general who's the equivalent of the U.S. commander in Europe or the Pacific.
CBS News correspondent David Martin at the Pentagon on the year-end roundup. Thank you, David.
Sure thing.
We have a lot more coming up to remind you of the major stories of the last year, including those we lost.
2018, the year we lost former President George H.W. Bush.
On the CBS News Year-End Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Every week, an extended conversation at a restaurant in our nation's capital with newsmakers like Democratic Senator Mark Warner.
What we want to try to do is give the American people the truth.
Trump cabinet member Linda McMahon.
First time that I met Donald Trump was at a Rolling Stones concert.
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
He has keys to the universe.
Actually, it's a key fob.
Right. You have a fob to the universe. Politics, policy, and a side of pop culture. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
On the CBS News Year-End Roundup, a special program recapping 2018. Here's Steve Dorsey.
Deborah Patta covers Africa for CBS News, and we're speaking with her from Johannesburg, South Africa. Deborah, you've been monitoring the Ebola epidemic in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. What are those challenges for health workers trying to control the outbreak?
Now, not only do they face the dangers of exposure to this deadly virus, but their physical safety is being threatened. I mean, we've seen attacks where militia kill civilians, they abduct children who they take as often as child soldiers. Beni, which is a city in the northeastern part of Congo, is the center of these attacks. We know of at least two health workers that have been shot dead by Congolese rebels. So it's very dangerous. They report hearing gunfire throughout the day. They have to operate under the armed escort of United Nations peacekeepers or the Congolese security forces, and they have to end work by sundown. But the biggest problem is that the violence is hampering the efforts, because you can't vaccine people if you can't find them. And every time there is attack, people flee the area, sometimes even across the border. And if they have come into contact with an Ebola sufferer, with them goes the hope of trying to contain the virus, because they can't vaccine them. The idea is, if you contract Ebola, we vaccinate you and everybody around you. So we have that sort of circle of immunity to try and stop the virus from spreading. The other problem is that every time violence occurs, the health workers suspend their work, so they lose a day. And one of the biggest things about Ebola is quick, fast action.
Also in the DRC, Deborah, you've been investigating child minors. What are kids going through there?
We do a lot of devastating stories, sadly, in Africa, but this is certainly one of the most devastating I have ever had to look at. The issue in the DRC is cobalt. Almost 60% of the world's supply of cobalt comes from the DRC. And the UN estimates around 40,000 children are involved in mining it. Now, that's just an official estimate. It's probably a lot higher than that. And we're talking about children who are, you know, I've got a young daughter, younger than my daughter, 10 years old, we saw some even younger, 4 years old. And these children are mining cobalt. Cobalt is used in everything from our iPhones, from our smartphones, our laptops, electronic vehicles. And the price of the mineral nearly tripled last year as demand for electric cars has soared, you know, given the sort of environmental concerns. We traveled to the DRC. We saw children, you know, literally carrying the weight of the world on their shoulders. They were digging in trenches and lakes, working incredibly hard.
I think another story that you've gotten a lot of feedback on is this poaching saga and efforts to combat poaching and the killing of endangered or vulnerable animals. How successful have those efforts been?
You know, it's a war that shifts. So, for example, in South Africa, the biggest problem in South Africa is rhino poaching. And you know, this number has kind of been steadily rising. There was a slight decline in some of the latest statistics, but it's still unacceptably high. You know, we're talking in the hundreds that rhinos are being, it's almost like industrial, the level of rhino horn that has been poached, sent to Asian countries, often Vietnam, where it's often used as a party drug. You know, people go and they snort powdered, pulverized rhino horn, which does nothing. It is like doing that to your nail. It's really is, has absolutely zero effect on anything, and yet it's got this sort of mystique around it, and so people poach these rhino. So, for example, we've seen in the Kruger National Park in South Africa, the biggest game reserve in South Africa, considerable efforts where they've, you know, set up this electronic monitoring. They've actually got a criminal court in the game reserve, so if they catch a poacher, they can bring them to justice straight away. But these are the foot soldiers. They're not the bosses of the syndicates. They're not the Asian bosses of the syndicates, and so it's very difficult to stem it on that level. And one of the things that environmentalists are saying is that rhino poaching and elephant ivory poaching should be treated as organized crime. It's the bosses at the top who make a lot of the money. We've seen efforts, for example, in China, where they've shut down ivory carving factories. So it's no longer legal to buy or to carve in China. It's an ancient art there, it's considered. But what's happened is now you've seen those carving factories being set up in places like Zimbabwe, where people are actually carving ivory at source, as it were. They get poached from the elephants and then get carved in the country. And you know, people are still buying it and managing to smuggle it out of the country.
Finally, Deborah, a little closer to home for you. How has that drought in Cape Town changed how they approach or conserve water?
It's a very interesting question, and I'm glad you asked that, because I think, you know, Cape Town's this beautiful tourist mecca. I mean, it attracts thousands of tourists every year. It is a city that is surrounded by water, the ocean, and yet it was a city that was desperately grappling with dramatic water supplies, largely caused by climate change. And so the city said, you know, there's going to be D-Day. We are going to run, the taps will run dry on this day unless people start changing their habits. And what they did was they enforced severe water restrictions where, you know, you could sort of have a bucket of water just about a day per person, which you had to shower, and then you had to reuse water to wash dishes. You had to let your gardens run dry. Now, there have been rains, so the dams have lifted. But what they've done is that they've lifted the restrictions a little bit. So you can use a little more water. It's not quite as hectic, but they haven't lifted them completely. And the sort of habits that people have grown into, you've started seeing taking place.
And perhaps an example for future places where water is an issue.
Precisely, because water is a resource that we all need to conserve. And this is the first city that has nearly run out of water.
CBS News correspondent Deborah Patta in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good talking with you.
Thank you.
Let's remember now some of the icons we lost in 2018.
2018, the year we lost former President George H.W. Bush.
I see history as a book with many pages.
As well as his wife, Barbara.
I love my life. I love my family.
The nation also paid its respects to Senator John McCain for his life of public service.
Duty, honor, country.
Jesus Christ, the Son of God.
The Reverend Billy Graham brought the divine to the world through his sermons.
Baby, baby, sweet baby.
Aretha Franklin brought heaven to the world with her songs. Physicist Stephen Hawking demonstrated that physical limitations don't cripple minds.
I have wanted to know how the universe operates and why.
Marvel comic Stan Lee let us know that even superheroes can have acne.
I guess one person can make a difference.
Though in Whitey Bulger's case, one man did great harm.
He essentially was a one-person crime wave in the city of Boston.
In sports,
a home run for Rusty Stahl.
Farewell to baseball's Grand Orange. And goodbye to actor Burt Reynolds.
Well, talk to me, good buddy.
You and the others will be talked about for years to come. Jim Shenavy, CBS News.
A memorable year, that's for sure. We're on the radio and online to find us anytime. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. The year-end roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor, and I'm Steve Dorsey.